this is a spoiler.
You can't listen to this and not have spoilers.
So, Lord Jim.
Well, I take from the lack of clamoring. I wonder how everybody felt about this right off the start.
I loved it.
The book,
yeah.
But when I suggested it, I don't think I really understood how complex a book it was, and so I wish I'd given myself more, because this is as dense as any LCSP or anything like that.
Oh yeah.
I wish I'd given myself more of an opportunity to do a reread, because I don't know how much of this you can really conquer on a first read. Anybody else feel that way?
Yeah. Conrad's style, it's so winding, but I did like it, but it takes a lot to get something out of this, because, speaking of being non-linear, it just goes all over the place.
And the description, I think the language, and it's might be something of the time, but, if you could cut out, all the adverbs and adjectives or whatever, you would greatly shave this thing down. However, I think that, writing used to be a different thing or a different kind of media anyway, so that the descriptions actually made it sing more, whereas maybe nowadays people have more mental images, so it's less encouraged or something. I don't know, but it's very not flowery, because that implies, I guess, that it might be unnecessary somehow. But
I had to look up more words in this book than I have in any book in maybe ever. But I thought that was great fun.
It's weird that he didn't learn English. It was in his 20s.
Well, he certainly used the hell out of it.
Maybe it's a style of writing, but I just felt like he was really struggling with, the soul of humanity, and that's always an interesting undertaking to see someone really dive in.
Yes.
Why don't you go ahead, Daniel, so we can attack it.
All right. Well, I'll just try to give a bare bones summary, because as Cesare sort of already said, the way it's written is nonlinear. It's epistolary. Is that the word? Throughout a lot of the novel. And
yeah, it's similar to Frankenstein, even, or a lot of the other books we've read, where it's a narrative about a narrative.
Yeah, many right. different accounts. And as you continue to read, you sort of realize that this element of the form is tightly interwoven with the act of interpreting the novel, and the reader is sort of out to sea, so to speak, for a lot of it. You're left to sort of try to interpret, but you're definitely, Conrad throws a lot at you, and you're not given clarity. You're left sort of wanting clarity a lot. But with that said, the novel is about this guy, Jim. He's a young seaman. He's the son of a parson. I don't know how important that is or not, but he's sort of a romantic figure, and he's at the beginning of a career at sea, and he's got imagination and a lot of gusto, and he's looking to assert himself against the world, and he takes on various jobs and on different ships, and eventually he lands a position on board the Patna, and during the course of that position, he's the chief mate, and something happens. The boat runs across maybe another floating vessel or an iceberg or something. It hits some sort of underwater object and begins to leak, and the crew panics. They're carrying a lot of Muslim passengers to Mecca. The crew begins to panic and all start to abandon ship, and unbeknownst to all of the passengers, this is all going on, and Jim is sort of in a position where he has to decide whether he's going to abandon ship with the rest of the crew or if he's going to go down with the ship, which seems, you're led to believe, is to almost certainly be sinking. And at the last minute, he jumps into the sea and aboard the rowboat or whatever it is that they're abandoning ship in. And this is the pivotal moment of the novel, is what was going through his mind when he jumped overboard, because he had intended to go down with the ship. And from there, it turns out the Patna did not sink. He goes back and faces trial with the rest of the crew, but they sort of duck out of the trial, and he's left on trial alone for the event, because when the Patna comes in, it's clear that the crew has sort of abandoned their duties, and it's not a criminal trial. It's a trial to revoke his certificate of officership or something like that. And he bears this out, and he meets a guy named Marlowe, who goes on to be the narrator of the rest of the novel for the most part, and basically ruined. But he's also sort of spiritually destitute at that point. He's questioning his actions. He's questioning his character. and Marlowe gets him various positions, tries to sort of get him back on his feet. He refuses to do this. He refuses to take the opportunities given to him. And then the places where Marlowe is able to get him on, this tail of the Padna follows him around, and every time he's recognized as being an officer aboard it, he has to flee that situation, find a new situation for himself. Finally, Marlowe introduces him to this guy named Stein, and Stein has the idea to set Jim up as his man at this trading outpost in a place called Patasan, and he takes this as a new opportunity to sort of leave the world of white men, I guess, and go into the unknown and start over. He's totally abandoned everything about the life he's had before, and so he's set up in this trading outpost and begins a new situation for him. He becomes a figure of mystery for the people there. He becomes sort of a lord to them, and he becomes Lord Jim, basically, and almost sort of a god, and he helps the poor people out. There's a struggle with the different factions there, and eventually he overcomes this struggle and he gets a place and is a celebrated guy until this other group of bandits shows up, led by this guy, Gentleman Brown, who come in with the intent to rob the place and basically pillage, and they don't realize that the situation that Jim has created there is going to be much more fortified than what they expect to find. But it sort of upends Jim's situation as well, and he's met with these guys who've come in to create chaos and steal. And this is the second pivotal moment of the novel. Jim confronts Gentleman Brown, and he's forced to make another decision about whether or not to kill him and his group of bandits, and he chooses to let him go, and that ends up being a fateful decision because the guy breaks his word. Gentleman Brown promises to go back to his boat and just leave, but instead he kills Jim's friend and a group of his tribesmen. Again, this basically ruins Jim in the place. It ruins Jim in his own character as well. And Jim, crestfallen, goes back to his friend's father, who, in a fit of grief and rage, shoots him dead. And this whole time, Marlowe is relating the story of all of this to you. So he sort of gets pieced together in Jim's fate and tells it in a letter sent to some anonymous person. And he has the last word on what happens to Jim, but it's all sort of hearsay. But that's the basic plot. You guys can tell me if I left anything important out.
You did a good job.
Yeah, well done. For a very complicated novel.
Oh, it's far more complicated than I just said.
Yeah.
So.
Sure.
Yeah, and I think that there's a lot that's built in. I mean, there's a lot going on in the novel, but I think that, so for instance, you know, whenever Jim discovers the bulkhead is going to come loose, you know, that takes up quite a bit of the narration there. And, you know, and understanding that position, I think, is what kind of like turns the story a little bit for Marlowe, because is it sympathetic, you know, or is he a deserter? And trying to come up with, well, what would you do? And that being the question, you know, Jim asks him a lot. Do you think that you would have done anything differently? Do you think that you could have? Do you think that I was scared of dying and that's why I was afraid? And he laughs at that notion and says, you know, it was just entirely pointless. And anybody in that position, you couldn't be. And I'll never be in that position again. And I'm really interested in that, you know, his feeling about the whole situation being grossly unfair, a joke, hatched in hell.
What you mean
the sinking of the well
sinking
the
sinking of the ship.
The danger to the Patna, you know, because it didn't sink, and I could see that
no,
coming.
It didn't, but
you know, I was like, oh man, wouldn't it be
see
awful?
That coming at, I didn't see that coming at all. And when it happened, it was a shock. I was like, oh man. I mean, because I think the basic idea is knowing yourself and disappointing yourself when you find out that you're not quite the person that you thought you were, and then to have something come up like that, ouch, you know, it's like you would have been okay if you had stuck to your guns, because I think that that moment that he went over the boat, he wasn't thinking at all. It was sheer terror. He was terrified that he was going to die.
Yeah, he doesn't remember jumping even. He just knows that he must have.
Yeah, so over the side he goes, and he would have stopped the others had they not put the boat, you know, like I think that he would have stopped them eventually, but he let them, you know, he didn't help them get the boat into the water.
Yeah, I was unclear about that. So there's like three guys or something like that. They were trying to get a boat off while everybody else was asleep.
You mean the lifeboat, yeah.
The lifeboat. So they had I guess they didn't know that the bulkhead was damaged, but they knew that they were hit. Is that right? Or did, because he comes up.
I think they knew they were. They thought it was sinking. The guys come sinking, up. They come up from the engine room from underneath, and they know.
But it was a small group of people that knew this, right? So Jim was the one that went down. And Jim goes down to investigate, and he sees that it's really about to just come undone. And the other guys are already doing something. Okay, that makes sense to me now.
Yeah. And the fourth guy dies. Fourth guy dies on the Patna.
Yeah. He has like a heart failure, I think. Yeah. Or that's the suggestion. You don't really know what exactly happened, but you know,
the other three guys think that Jim is the fourth guy until they're away, and then they find out it's Jim, and they threaten him.
Because they think that he killed him as well. He killed the other guy on the deck of the Patna.
Was he even liked by the crew on the Patna?
I think he kept a kind of above and away from them. I think that he was a classier guy, let's just say.
And I think his job...
He liked to think of himself that way.
I think that he had a better upbringing, etc. Sorry, Daniel. Yeah.
No, and that just gets to say that goes into why there was a distance between he and they as soon as he was in the boat and they realized it was him, because he had sat as if he was going to go down with the ship until the last minute, and that created sort of this chasm between his character. He was very open about his contempt for them as they were getting the boat ready to go, and then suddenly he shows up, he's in the boat with them.
And also, I think when they were in the boat, they started almost immediately talking about what their story's going to be, and Jim's like, you guys can talk all you want, I'm just going to say the truth, right?
Yeah, they were trying to come up with a story because it might seem that they were, you know, explain why you're the survivors, and they wanted to get that straight, because it wouldn't look good, and they're looking, and they're, you know, trying to see the lights of the ship and the squall that just comes. Not only are they hit, but they're attacked by a squall, that threatens to, just swallow everything. Yeah. And, so they're looking back and trying to see the lights go down, and you get my impression was that they were, hoping after it, when is this thing going to go down? You know, like, it has to go down in order for our decision not to be cowards. And then whenever they finally do see the lights go, there's a little bit of a relief, but then that one guy breaks down and just starts crying because I think that he realizes the finality of what's happened.
And the reader is sort of kept in the dark along with them for a while. You're led to believe that it probably sank, just as, they believe that. And it's only later on in the book, a quarter of the way through, that you find out that Patna actually was picked up and came into harbor.
Well, and the personal narrative of Jim is so compelling because, like, you go down there, and I don't know anything about ships, and so I really enjoyed how it put you in the position of the ship. You know, it really set you up that, there's no one around to help. It's just a cold sea underneath you, and it's constantly trying to bring you down, and these are the things that could go wrong. And, he goes down there, and he sees rust the size of your hand falling off of the bulkhead that's supposed to keep, everything firm and, separate, and he sees it getting ready to come undone. And so whenever he stumbles out of there, he thinks that before he takes his next breath, that he's going to be overwhelmed and drowning. And he walks out into sees all these people and just notices the horror of them being rushed over with water. He's overwhelmed with the stories of ships that he knows too. I think that's part of his job. He works with many ships, and so he kind of gets a story and a culture of, and so he knows about ships going down. He knows about and all of that's just blaring in his mind at that time and stops him from even saying a word, because he sees himself saying a word and then sees the ship bursting forth from underneath and then thinks it's futile, and he doesn't know what to do. He doesn't know how to act.
Well, it's not only futile. I mean, the whole thing, the whole enterprise was bad from the get-go. This wasn't a passenger ship. These people were down in the hold. They were, was it 600 or 800 people? Yeah, this is a cargo ship. Humans aren't cargo. And they, they make this deal to take these people to Mecca or wherever it is they're going to go to celebrate Muslim holiday. And there shouldn't have been that many people on the ship. So it was wrong in the first place. Him taking this position was a bad position that he was in from the start. And he knew that if there were six lifeboats, there's no way you're going to get 600 or 800 people into six lifeboats. So he knew that there would be panic, mm-hmm. and that waking them up would be worse than just letting them drown, because they would kill each other if they woke up.
Is that what you would think?
I mean, think about it for a second. There are six lifeboats and there are 800 people or 100 people. It doesn't even matter. There's going to be panic And so
the question becomes, and I thought about this. Really die with them. I agree with you. What?
Do you stay and die with them, or do you, you know, go over in a, do you, you know, sneak off?
What I was thinking about it was in terms of number, because the people who got off the ship, putting aside the fact that the ship never sank, all right, let's just put that aside. But they don't know that, you know, at the time. Jim doesn't know that. The captain doesn't know that when they're jumping off and getting into the lifeboat. They don't know that the ship is not going to sink. Okay, so then, and Jim is thinking this, and we're all thinking it with him, okay, about the panic if we wake up these 800 vessels, and that there are only, what was it, six lifeboats? And there's not enough, and that it would cause that panic. And so then I was thinking, well, then it comes down to the question, and this is really where Jim was in that very intense, pregnant moment. Do I save myself? Do I save the smaller amount of people? Because we can't save the larger amount of people. And then the question becomes the value of a given life, a single life. I was even thinking it in terms of the doctor's oath, you know, doctors take this oath, and the value of life is above everything else, even one single life. Because at a certain point, it becomes a question of numbers.
There's also the whole thing about you go down with your ship. You're not supposed,
right,
you know,
yeah,
taking
exactly
on this responsibility. You're not supposed to get off the ship. It's just the way
exactly
it goes with, you know, nautical life. So there is something very cowardly about leaving the ship, period. And Jim, who's, you know, sees himself as courageous, has, whatever he does, whatever it is with these people, he's missed his own mark. I don't, you know, as far as the responsibility are concerned, I think that his, you know, his greatest sin is toward himself. He has really done a bad thing to himself.
Shouldn't he be oriented towards others, like you're saying? I mean, there's a part of him that's narcissistically self-absorbed. You know, he's narcissistically oriented when he's in a position of service. You know, he's in a position of being the person who's supposed to look after these people. But he's also imagining and daydreaming and lusting for his chance to be tested by the sea, to be tested by fate. And that's what occupies his thoughts. And so there's a question of motivation there in his act. Even were he to remain on the ship, you know, is he going down with the ship? Is that the best course of action in terms of, I mean, is he playing a hero for his own sake, or is he playing a hero because that's the right thing to do?
Right. Well, you take a position like that. You take a position of command, or you want a position of command on a ship, and it is it's a position of responsibility. And the fact is that he's already in a bad position with himself because he's on a bad voyage. This is not the way it's supposed to go. You don't fill an old cargo ship with people, and people whom you believe to be lesser than you anyway because they're not Christians and because they're not white. So they, you know, there they are, they're cargo. And then all of a sudden something happens and your cargo turns out to be humans.
Yeah.
You actually have to say, like, oh, well, what do I actually feel about this? And what do I feel about my, you know, what? How do I actually relate to my own responsibility in this? And it seems like he has a huge argument with himself about it. You know, he's wandering around the ship despondent.
Yeah, I mean, I think that he's trying to, you know, he walks you through this action. He's trying to get up and run out and say something, you know, and he sees that everyone's asleep, and he says, okay, well, I can't wake them up because they don't know what they're doing either, and it'll just cause a panic. So I got to get upstairs. Okay, I got to get upstairs. And, like, you know, it takes him a while to do all this, but he's really trying to do the right thing throughout. And so, you know, someone grabs him, you know, for water, and they want, you know, more water than their rations. And, you know, he's got to fight that battle. And then he goes, and he thinks it's absurd that he's even doing this right now. He's like, you don't even understand. I'm trying to go and, you know, the bomb is counting down right now, and you're grabbing me and won't let me go, and I've got to get you water. And he, you know, throws the bottle of water, goes upstairs, almost gets hit in the head by, you know, something on the ship swinging around. Other people are working on the boat, and he just keeps being stopped, and he keeps seeing this, you know, an appalling joke again. You know, he feels that he's thrust into a situation that no one can understand, and that even if he had taken on these responsibilities, it's a ridiculous situation. You know, there's not any kind of preparation, or, you know, we think that we have order. We know that we're going to behave, or, you know, how we want to behave. And then we're put in the actual situation, and then what do we do? And, I mean, I know that that's kind of reiterated, but the immensity of the situation, I mean, understanding how someone could be like stuck to the ground, even though you've got water, you know, coming in. You know, it makes sense whenever you realize that, you know, how, you know, I think that we not knowing anything about ships, it's like, oh, well, you would just put something over it, right? But there's nothing to do. And, you know, he says, don't you think that I thought about reinforcing the bulkhead, like in the conversation? I tried, but what are you going to reinforce it with out of the materials and in 5 minutes with no hands around to help you? It's like that would have been impossible, so that wasn't an option. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, he's trying to do the best that he can. And it's not until he's at the end of his, you know, rope looking down at, I mean, that dividing line, and he doesn't even know where the line is. You know, he doesn't even say, and then I made the decision to jump. You know, it's just, I must have jumped because I did, but I don't remember that. It wasn't out of fear of death or anything. It just...
Except you're supposed to go down
with the ship. Yeah, you know, but I think that what this, there's other points in the narration, kind of a theme, and I think that they're talking about, or that Conrad's getting at something about how we have these conventions of morality that we expect that we're in line with, and
I'm thinking of this small paragraph I see on page 12 where it says, thinking at such times his thoughts would be full of valorous deeds. He loved these dreams and the success of his imaginary achievements. They were the best parts of his life. Its secret truth, its hidden reality. I mean, he was romantic and an idealist. And narcissistic, as Daniel pointed out. And also, how old is he? Isn't he kind of young?
Yeah, I think
a
like
vague
20.
Memory of Marlowe. What?
I think he's 20 or around there.
Yeah, Jim, at 24 at one point in the text, but I think that was even after this. So, yeah, early 20s.
Well, yeah, I mean, not to put down early 20s, but it is kind of youngish. And so, yeah, I mean, there is that there, too, you know, that he struggles with this idealism that he had about who he is, who he is, as opposed to who he should be. Because
yeah.
Who he is not really who he is.
Oh, I was just going to quote something I thought got that, but...
I was too, so go ahead. You do.
Let's see if we got the same thing. It's on chapter 2, my page 10, first paragraph. He was gentlemanly, steady, tractable, with a thorough knowledge of his duties, and in time, when yet very young, he became chief mate of a fine ship without ever having been tested by those events of the sea that show in the light of day the inner worth of a man, the edge of his temper and the fiber of his stuff, that reveal the quality of his resistance and the secret truth of his pretenses, not only to others, but also to himself. And so they're talking about him having a metal that hasn't been tested, and then it was tested in one of the most ridiculously horrible ways. You know, I mean, from his point of view, a conspiracy of bad luck. And
yeah, mine is in chapter 8, Marlowe talking, I can't explain to you who haven't seen him and who hear his words only at second hand the mixed nature of my feelings. It seemed to me that I was being made to comprehend the inconceivable, and I know nothing to compare with the discomfort of such a sensation. I was made to look at the convention that lurks in all truth and on the essential sincerity of falsehood. He appealed to all sides at once, to the side turned perpetually to the light of day, and to the side of us which, like the other hemisphere of the moon, exists stealthily in perpetual darkness, with only a fearful ashy light falling at times on the edge. He swayed me. I own to it. I own up. The occasion was obscure, insignificant, what you will. A lost youngster, one in a million. But then he was one of us, an incident as completely devoid of importance as the flooding of an ant heap, and yet the mystery of his attitude got hold of me as though he had been an individual in the forefront of his kind, as if the obscure truth involved were monumental enough to affect mankind's conception of itself.
I had that
it
one
sort of makes me think of car accidents, you know. All the time, you know, we're in cars, we're driving, and the slightest little lapse and could lead to disaster, right? But we have probability on our side in such a way that usually that isn't going to happen to us. But when it does happen to people, I mean, the disaster can be so complete that it's impossible to, or something in us just cries out that this isn't an accident, you know, and we want to place blame. But, you know, we know, I think deep down, when our emotions are quiet enough to let us perceive it, that any of us could be at the wheel when, you know, something like that happens, you know, when something catches our eye and we look to the side and a child might have run out on the road or something like that, you know, it could happen to anybody. And yet, you know, are you to blame for that moment or not? I mean, you did.
No, but there's a difference. It's different. because he's an officer on a ship. It's a different standard. It's a higher standard.
But is that the complete conflict, though? I mean, that gives it extra weight, certainly, and he's judged in that tribunal for it. But do you think it was them four and one of the men, like one of the Muslim men going to Mecca, that somehow snuck onto the ship, would there not be a moral judgment of that person as well for what he had done, leaving behind the other 700 people, or whoever was on that ship?
Good question.
There's more to it. I mean, certainly a big part of it is that they're officers and they left their charge. But just making the decision as a person, as a human, to save yourself instead of someone else is...
So I kind of missed the crux of that. Your point being is that the fact that he's an officer of the ship is not really persuasive.
Well, it certainly adds weight to the moral decision that he made. But I think just being a human being and making the decision to save yourself rather than one of the other 700 people on that ship is a conflict in itself. And I think even if he, for instance, was, the mop boy on the ship and had made the same decision, he'd still have that same conflict as a person.
Of course he would, but I don't agree that it's not, that it just isn't nearly just extra weight. What if, you can look at a situation where there was a doctor and there was a problem with a given patient, and fixing the problem with that given patient would somehow cause that doctor to either lose their life or lose their job or lose their reputation. I just think that there are different standards of, profession, different standards of what we're required to do, expected of us. And being human, of course, is a big part of it, but it's not the only part. I mean, to bottom line, I really can't stand Jim.
You really don't like him?
I don't like him. I'm sorry. I don't like him.
I see much of humanity in him. Because I don't think that we all can, I think that it's fine to go and join a profession where you think that you can find glory and stuff like that. But I think that when it comes to the moment of actually, life and death, that there is something that is very human about wanting to save. I mean, it's our most basic instinct. And I think that it's weird to say, well, just because you took this job, you have to be willing to give your life. Like, it's, we're not all Secret Service agents. We're not all going to throw ourselves in front of a president or whomever and give our lives for someone else's. I mean, this is like what we talked about in the Camus. I mean, how?
Yeah, I know.
At what point does it, at what point do you allow yourself to actually live rather than, and I don't even know how much going down with the ship at that time, how much going down with the ship was actually at the forefront. I don't know what I think that the standard was, I think that the thing is more that he didn't even try because he saw it as a lost cause. I mean, it was a lost cause because there were too many people. And I think that if he were truly going to take responsibility, it would have been that he was responsible enough to not have taken this job, to not have agreed to shove 600 or 800 people into the hold of an old crappy ship.
But yeah, and I agree with you, and I agree that you're right. At the crux of this, at the center of this, is this great human dilemma. However, I think you're looking at it from the point of view of Jim versus the point of view of the Muslims down below asleep. You get on a boat, you get on a plane, you get on a bus. You're just assuming that you're going to be covered by whoever is running that vehicle, whoever is in charge of that vehicle.
Really? How many times would you get onto a bus with 600 people in the hold? I don't think that it's the same thing, because they obviously put themselves into a bad situation. You can't put everything on the people with the ship.
If they saw that this was going to be that critical of an issue in the great scheme of what could happen, possibly could happen, then they shouldn't have allowed it to happen. They're in charge of the ship.
That's what I'm saying his dilemma was.
Yeah.
It was from the beginning, not from that moment. It was from the get-go. He should not have agreed to be part of the enterprise.
I think that's a larger critique on, we can bring in workplace safety and how, just as a matter of him trying to improve his station in life, I mean, if he was a rich aristocrat, he wouldn't, of course he could refuse, but I'm guessing that, getting on this rusting, about to sink ship wasn't his first choice.
He wasn't the one that had the, he wasn't the one in charge who allowed 600, 800 Muslims to come on.
And I think it's important also that, I mean, he wasn't the captain. He wasn't the man in charge. I don't even think he was, like, the second in charge.
Yeah,
so,
I agree.
And it's also, I think, like, this is a very internal conflict, but materially what he did is almost no different from what the other three, the captain included, did when they escaped the ship. And it didn't seem that this conflict or this decision defined the rest of their lives for them in this way, same way that it did Jim, when really it should have, right? Like, the captain mm-hmm. slunk off after the trial, and I'm sure he's off sailing a ship or eating caviar or whatever he's doing, and not sailing to the remote parts of the world trying to fix this one mistake that he did in his life, like Jim does.
Didn't one guy go nuts, though? Didn't one guy just fall to pieces afterward? I can't remember. They got himself into some sort of sanatorium and fell apart. Sorry, I don't remember.
There was one guy who started drinking immediately upon getting back to shore and was in DTs, basically, but when the trial was going on.
You know, I think that, I mean, we're really getting into it, and I think that the novel pulls these threads out, like, a little bit more, so thinking about the trial itself, I think that he said something interesting, and this is on chapter 6, whether they, the people holding the trial of, you know, Jim and of this inquiry, knew it or not, their interest that drew them there was purely psychological. The expectation of some essential disclosure as to the strength, the power, the horror of human emotions. And just jumping down a little bit, an official inquiry could not be any other thing. Its object was not the fundamental why, but the superficial how of the affair. And I think that really hit me, because what they're looking for is not some kind of justice or really getting to the bottom of it or figure. I mean, what they want to see is, like, into the face of this person who saw something that no one else saw. I mean, they want to know from the only person what, you know, the horrors that they saw, you know. I mean, someone who was, you know, stood stock still, and they want to be able to blame him. They want to be able to find, you know, his iniquities or the weaknesses of his spirit and figure out something, and maybe just compare themselves against it, and want at the end of it to be able to, you know, bang the gavel and condemn this guy. But the frustration of everybody is that they kind of know this, and they are looking at Jim the whole time, and why doesn't he just run off and run away with his cowardice? It would be better for him and for everybody, and everybody would know that he was a coward, and everybody could say that he was a coward. But this guy is sitting there, and he's listening to everything and answering questions. And this is a little later, and the people want facts, as if facts could tell you anything about what was going on. In that courtroom, you get Captain Brierly, who runs an immaculate ship, right, who is the epitome of superior seaworthiness. You know, he's never had, you know, he's got, like, a stellar record, you know, was given gifts by the councils of nautical people or whatever, and he's shaken by the trial and what Jim saw. And I think without Jim being there and holding court, that would never have come to light. And the actual challenge of looking at the problem in the face couldn't have been even reckoned. And so Brierly is really tormented by this, and I believe it's what leads him to suicide. And that suicide is so unexpected, and I think he's grappling with questions of responsibility and maybe wondering if his time isn't coming himself, and not wanting to face such a dishonor. It was only a couple of days after the trial, I think, or maybe a week, when he was back out at sea. So I think that there's more going on here internally, psychologically, with the characters dealing with this. I mean, obviously Jim's trying to get retribution for the rest of his life, but I think that other people are seeing this and really wondering, Marlowe, what would I have done? And Brierly, like, what could happen to me?
Was he at a real risk, Brierly?
I think that he saw the potentiality. That, you know, things went well his way, but he could see, and maybe this isn't right, but I think that he could see Jim's position and say, yeah, that could happen. That I can see where you're coming from, and even so, you would still be dishonored. And I don't want to face that, and so...
Meaning that he would likely make the same choice, that he figures that he has that theoretical weakness.
Yeah, I think before he didn't have the empathy. And he couldn't have imagined himself as someone capable of that. But after hearing Jim's testimony, I think that changed for him.
I think his realization is that it may not come down to a choice.
Yes, I think that's really key. I think that's what this is circling around, and certainly the crux between Marlowe and Jim's discourse is, what do you think? Do you think that you would? I'm sorry, please, yeah, Daniel.
I think Brierly sees that... any that there may a conspiracy of circumstances may arise that presents you with a sort of unavoidable twist of fate, so as to expose your mastery of your fate, your agency as a sort of illusion. And he's afraid of being Jim. You know, he's got everything together. The trial I took as a sort of ritual to reaffirm human agency. And just like you were saying, Nathan, they're wanting Jim to play along. They're wanting him to take the blame and, you know, to play the character who is blameworthy. And because he won't, that's what's frustrating things. And that's why Brierley wants him to just, like, you know, get the hell out of there and, you know, sink into the earth, but he won't do it. And Brierley, I think, just like you're saying, I think he comes to the realization that if circumstances line up the right way, this may happen to him, and he may be faced with a circumstance where there is no choice. And so the only way to be sure that when presented with certain death, you will, in fact, assent to it, is to go ahead and jump right into it. And so that's what he does, because he's more afraid of having a reputation ruined than actually, you know.
Can you clarify this concept of where there would be no choice?
Well, the question is whether or not Jim actually did make a decision. And if he did, when did he make it? This is what he's trying to figure out.
This is really what this whole book is about.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Was this up to his reason?
I like the way you put that the trial is a trial for human agency. And I think, I mean, the way they've described the events of the sink almost sinking, there was no narrative in there where Jim was like, okay, the ship's going to sink. Do I jump? Do I not jump? Do I, like, this? There were just, like, flashes of things happening, and then, like you said, he didn't even remember jumping.
Yeah, and there's a little, this is here on my 81, and I think this is talking a little bit more of that distinction between, like, what you think of yourself and what in the conspiracy of circumstances, and it's this. There are always those struggles of an individual trying to save from the fire his idea of what his moral identity should be, this precious notion of a convention, only one of the rules of the game, nothing more, but all the same, so terribly effective by its assumption of unlimited power over natural instincts, by the awful penalties of its failure. And I think what he's saying there is that, you know, we have this idea of how we're going to react, and we imagine that we have this unlimited power over, you know, our natural instincts. But there's also this, you know, awful failure that can happen given this responsibility. And I think that's what he's trying to, you know, save from, you know, the fire there, is that he wants to maintain this, even though it might, you know, it can fail you so supremely. And what's worth holding on to, and so I think that's what drives Jim out to, you know, retribution, is trying to, you know, make up for this this failure and hold on to his moral identity.
Yeah, there was a part, I don't know if one of you guys remember exactly where it was, because the novel goes back to that moment so many times I can't really find it, but maybe remember there's a part where Marlowe is sort of speculating on this situation, and he's thinking, you know, maybe Jim had resigned himself, you know, through his imaginings and his daydreams, to die a heroic death. You know, maybe he'd resigned himself to death. But in that moment when terror took hold, you know, maybe he hadn't accounted for that. Maybe he hadn't accounted for panic, you know, or the prospect of an agonizing death, you know. Maybe the context, you know, that arose right then, even though he had resigned himself to die, was not something he'd resigned himself towards, because it couldn't have been anticipated.
Yeah, yep. I think when the moment comes, nobody's really ready.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's maybe a few people are ready, but I don't think it's...
Well, it's almost, I mean, definitionally, to be, like, heroic, it seems that it's a few and far between act to be a hero or to be doing heroic things. And yet, who has this thought in their heads that given a certain circumstance, you would not be heroic, you would be cowardly? But it seems like most of us are, almost by definition, just, you know, by being human, would not do the heroic thing and stay on the ship.
Did I tell you? Yeah. Did I tell you guys? This is a, you know, you're at the movies, and somebody's, you know, somebody's going to go into the room with the killer in it, and you're screaming at them, "Don't go in there! Don't go in there!" And I always thought of myself like, I'm never going to go in that room. Like, I'm going to be the one who doesn't go out, you know, from the cabin and go looking for my friends in the forest when there's a serial killer out there. But one night I was at, yeah, right. One night I was sitting on my sofa. And I heard this noise that sounded like the window in my bathroom, like being pushed in. And I immediately jumped up and ran into the other room and was like, "What?" You know? And it turned out that there's a mirror that was just kind of stuck to the wall with some sort of whatever. And it had fallen down. And I stood there and said, "I am the idiot that goes into the forest." I had always thought that I was smarter than that, and you know what? I'm not. I will run toward my death like an idiot. Not that I would say that. Not that I would go down with the ship to, you know, to save anybody. But I am that stupid. So I would say that you know, at those moments of panic, it's hard to know.
Well, what's fascinating, I think, is that, and I think this is Jim's mistake, is that he has left all of this up to it being a matter of character. But it isn't. I mean, you wouldn't join the fire department or the military and they say, "Okay, well, we're going to send you out to the front line based on speculation of your character." Like, no, you would go through drills, you would go through training. You know, you can have ethics, sure, but sometimes I think, like, no, you know, if we're going to have, like, you know, these lofty ethical ideas, we should drill for them. You know, you should drill for having to push the wheelchair down the stairwell in the fire. You know, if you expect yourself to be able to accomplish that, don't just leave it up to, you know, your lofty ideas about your moral fortitude.
Well, because like, most of our moral fortitude, what the way that it gets tested is in, you know, you go into the store and you don't steal stuff. Yeah. You know, you drive down the street and you don't cut someone off. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's pretty mild. It usually doesn't have to do with, you know, throwing yourself in front of a bus to save the old lady or something like that.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me of something I was thinking about the chaos of what Jim is going through in this novel, but also the chaos of the structure of the novel, which I found very chaotic. And I feel like Conrad did that specifically, he may not have, but I think he did, to reflect the struggle and the chaos within Jim's soul as a result of the decision he made. And the reason I'm thinking of this is what you're saying, Mary, is that what Jim wants, I mean, for some reason, Jim can't survive the choice that he made by not going, quote-unquote, down with the ship. He can't seem to survive that, hence this book. And as a result, you know, all he wants to do is to be able to survive it so that he can live like sort of this general sort of normal life of that we live without these profound, unlivable mistakes like what he has done. And like someone, there are people who can do that, like maybe Charles Manson or something, who can make these kind of unlivable, horrible choices, you know, when they're faced with it, you know. But Jim can't. He can't seem to survive this, you know.
There's also the idea that there, you know, you get thrown into circumstances. So the reason that he was there was that he had gotten sick, right? And he had had to stay in that place that didn't have a good, you know, there wasn't a good position for him on the ship going, you know, on a
right.
ship leaving.
Right.
And so he was taking whatever he could get. And, right. I don't know about you guys, but there have been times where it's like, yeah, I'll take this job. And then, but I'll only be here, you know, X number of months or whatever. And then I'll find something else. And then you're in the job and it's just like, oh my God, this work is so debilitating. Who has time to find another job? Like, who can even think about it? All I can think about is surviving.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but you get into these circumstances and that's not the, you know, these things that throw you curveballs through life are life, but they're not planned. No one plans to get sick and get stuck in a port for 6 months getting better and then, you know, being without any, you know, without any resources to actually get out of there. So he took what he could get. And so I think that is, you know, that's the start of it also. That's part of it also, is that, you know, your morals are fine when you're sitting in an armchair talking about them, You know, you can stand in a pulpit and preach about them, but when it comes right down to it, what do you actually do?
Yeah.
And the things Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, that was Conrad made that choice, right? To you know, put Jim in a situation where he had no, you know, kind of ended up in this situation that he couldn't, you know, he had to do this. You know,
because it's the most, because it's very ordinary in life for that to happen.
Right, right. And then he's faced, because that's another thing, because Conrad was a seaman. He was on sea a lot. He was, you know, this is why he's written mostly nautical stuff. But the thing is that he sees the sea as this, you know, huge force that is not conquerable. You can't conquer it.
I really think so.
Pardon me?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think that that's the thrust of this novel. I mean, is dealing with this, you know, this line or this this conflict.
Nature versus man.
Well, on 50, there's this, and I think this kind of gets to it. You know, Marlowe's talking, and he says that his curiosity about Jim was that I hoped I would find something profound and redeeming. Some merciful explanation, some convincing shadow of an excuse. I see well enough now that I hoped for the impossible, for the laying of what is the most obstinate ghost of man's creation, of the uneasy doubt uprising like a mist, secret and gnawing like a worm, more chilling than the certitude of death, the doubt of the sovereign power enthroned in a fixed standard of conduct. It's the hardest thing to stumble against. It's the living thing that breeds yelling panics and good, quiet little villainies. It's the true shadow of calamity. And I think that is the struggle that he's dealing with there. You know, I have this vision of how I'm going to act, and then whenever the poster falls down in the bathroom, right, jumping up onto the couch.
How many people did you hear say that they were going to move to Canada if Bush won? And then if Bush won the second time, then how many people are going to say that they're going to move to Canada if Trump wins? We all have lofty ideas, right?
Right.
It's easy when you're talking about them. I would never do that, and then you do it. I always think that maturity happens, you know, that maturity starts in human beings the first time that they truly have to ask for forgiveness. Like the first time that you truly fuck up and you truly have to go to someone and say, please forgive me, that's when maturity begins.
That's a good question. Did Jim ever ask for forgiveness?
I think his whole life was an act of asking for forgiveness.
Well, did we discuss whether we think Jim thinks he did something wrong, or does he go throughout his entire life never announcing, like always announcing that he had no choice? Because he never, when he faced his trial, he didn't say, oh, sorry, I fucked up, guys. Should have done that, and here I am at trial.
I think that he does own up with Marlowe. I think that he says as much but this is my mistake. This is for me to deal with. You can listen and ask these questions, but this is something that I'm grappling with as events that happen to me. I don't think that he finds the fault that there is. I think that he's looking for, I've said, like, you know, redemption or something, but... You know, he's searching for that, but I don't think that he feels as if it was his own... If anything, it's like, well, that bad thing happened to me, and I don't want to be there again, and I'm going to go out to the forefront. But I don't feel like he thinks that this is something that could even happen again, or that it was something that was innate within him, that, or maybe it was innate and internal and was revealed, and maybe he's making up for it. But, you know, he owns it as his dilemma, and I think that's the... Going back to the court, the frustration is that he's owning up to it. He's not just saying, it was impossible, I couldn't have done anything. He was like, no, I really thought about everything to do, and like this was,
you know,
moment to moment.
That makes me think of that. I'm sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, no, I was just going to agree that I agree with what you said, and I think like what he tries to get out of Marlowe is for Marlowe to tell him that that's what it was, as a unworkable dilemma.
Well, that makes me think... Mm.
Go ahead, Laura.
I'm sorry, what you were talking about, Nathan, and sorry, it makes me think of that conversation, the first conversation that Marlowe and Jim had at that restaurant or wherever, remember? Oh, when they were sitting at a table, and it was late at night, and they talked very late, and you could see in the way it was described by Conrad that the suffering that Jim was going through, you know, internally. And it says here, Jim says, this is on page 51, somebody was speaking aloud inside my head, he said a little wildly, 800 people in 7 boats and no time, just think of it. He leaned towards me, this is Marlowe talking, across the little table, and I tried to avoid his stare. Do you think I was afraid of death? Jim asked in a voice very fierce and low. He brought down his open hand with a bang that made the coffee cups dance. I'm ready to swear I was not. I was not, by God, no. He hitched himself upright and crossed his arms. His chin fell on his breast. He's saying that he was not afraid of death, or that he is not afraid of death, but he did not go down with the ship.
Yeah, I don't think that he was trying to save... I mean, I don't think that in any instance he was trying to save himself in his own narrative. He was simply dumbfounded by what could be done. It looked as if there was no time to do anything. Now, that's his judgment was not completely sound because the ship lasted, you know, turns out. And, you know, it wasn't so imminent as he thought, which is its own kind of, I mean, there's something to that, too. You know, there's an extra level where it's the unknown and, you know.
I wonder why Conrad made that choice. I mean, I think that probably adds another level of severe moral struggle by making the choice that the ship actually did not sink.
Oh, yeah, because, I mean, that's a totally different circumstance than if it did sink and all that's left is their thing, and then they could be like, oh, well, boys, look like you did it. You know, you did fine to get out of there. You know what I mean? Like, I can understand it. And
but he also turned out to not be a murderer because of that.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's another part of the choice. Like, he didn't kill anybody. He shamed himself.
Or, yeah, but he shamed himself but was going to kill everybody.
Well, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, this idea of the authority within it, you know, it makes me think of, I was just listening to this other podcast, and these guys were talking, and basically it was about, you know, shootings, you know, at venues, and bouncers being the first line, and meeting with, you know, bouncers in order to talk about what to do, and you know, one of the bouncers asked to the you know, the cop or the, you know, SWAT officer, whoever they were going to get advice from, you know, isn't it my responsibility, you know, to save all these people? And surprisingly, the cop had said back, like, well, that's noble of you, but not really. If this thing is going to happen, then it's going to happen. Someone can do these horrible things. By the time any help gets there, it's already over. And you can do certain things, but it's not wholly your responsibility, these external circumstances. And there's things that are out of your control. And so while people take up the mantle of captain and all that, and certainly there is a authority that they're imbuing themselves with, I mean, it's really coming down to the actual world and what's going on. And I think that there's no way you could know or prepare for these things that you've set yourself up to be, you know, steel against.
Yeah, I think that's right.
I mean, imagine a plane crashing. You know, I mean, it's kind of like the chance of the captain being able to get out is much slimmer of a possibility than the captain being able to jump over into a lifeboat.
Yeah, we can,
pretty
we
much everybody dies. I mean, that's a very different situation.
It's done. It's a done deal.
Can't forget
the other
that
thing,
he was...
Sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
I just got to pull on that thread with the, you know, the bouncer and Jim, is that he was the help. I mean, he wasn't rich by any means. He didn't have enough money to, like, escape, which seemed to be some nominal fee that Marlowe and Brearley put together really quickly. In the same sense that, I know I talked to a bouncer once, or a former bouncer, and he said he quit the day that he was patting someone down and they had a gun in their pants, and he says, like, you know, getting paid $10, it's not worth losing your life getting paid $10 an hour. So he quit. In the same sense that Jim was just the help.
Yeah, and although the help wasn't what he wanted to be, and I think that's where his own dilemma came with him, with himself, right? I mean, he thought that he could be more than he turned out to be, and I think that the unconsciousness of his act of going overboard is probably a lot bigger deal than we've made it out to be at this point.
And he's such a bumbling fool. I mean, like, with what we talked about, his the difference between how he perceives himself and how he acts, but it's not surprising how he acts when you hear the character speak. I mean, almost all the eloquence in the novel is provided by Marlowe. All the descriptions and all the explanations are provided by Marlowe, because when Jim speaks, it's just like, what will, you know, it was like, that kind of thing. And he mishears thing. Remember, I guess the first time he met Marlowe, he was going to fight him because some guy tripped over a dog and said, "You like dumb cur," and he thought Marlowe was like saying something to him, and he almost got in a big fight. I'm like, oh, like this is this person is so ill suited to deal with life.
Well, I think that gets to his unconscious there too, you know, about being, you know, thinking that the slur was aimed at him, you know, or that someone was calling him a wretched dog, and you know, and I think he wants to get it right. He wants to be on the record of saying, "Listen, this is what happened, and I'll stand by it, but what do you think about that? Like, would you say, you know, you judges, that you would be, that you could have done anything different, or that you would have?"
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I think there's that, and I think it's the novel's full of those mistaken impressions, right? Because there's him mistaking Marlowe for calling him a mangy cur, and then there's the part Nathan brought up earlier when he's traipsing through the passengers in the ship as it's as he thinks it's going down, and the guy grabs him and he asks for water. He at first thinks he's saying something about the potential flooding, you know, because he's lost in his own thoughts and his own panic. But the guy's only asking for a drink of water for his kid. He doesn't know anything about the potential flooding. And you know, from there you can go on to the bigger mistakes about, you know, failures to perceive. Like Brown's character and his intentions, you know, that's his second major mistake, his major misread. And I think the mistaken impressions get at this failure of ideas and perceptions to adhere to reality. And the fantasies and the myths and the daydreams that we want to project onto the world may only be fooling us. We don't know if they actually give us a real affordance on reality, or if they're only sort of prescriptions to adjust our own anxiety. You know, anytime you have a problem, you've basically got two options. You know, you can adjust the outer, you know, the world, or you can adjust your inside. Those are your two options. And Jim is trapped between these two things because he refuses to alter his perception of events, his code of conduct, right? But he's lost his chance to alter outside events. So he's sort of stuck. You know, the other guys, they do alter the inner, and that's how they get away with it.
I think that Brown was the third mistake, because I think the second mistake was, what was the guy's name that he went to, who he went to replace his...
Cornelius?
Yeah, his gal's, you know, stepdad, or, you know, acting father. Because he's the one who betrayed them, who betrayed him to Brown, isn't he?
Yes.
So he didn't act as he should have with him. He just thought, oh well, you know, this is my thing now, and you know, you'll be fine. But if he had actually examined this guy, who was obviously a really bad guy, and done something about it, then that was another thing that he could have done that would have changed the circumstance.
Yeah. He's left so uncertain by the events that have happened. It sort of undermined his ability to make a call. And now he's gun-shy, because to make a determination about the character of another individual would mean that he would have to make a determination about his own character. But that's what he doesn't feel like he can do anymore, because the certainty that he had has sort of been abolished by, you know, the fire test.
Yeah, and that whole scene where he's talking with Brown across the creek, and Brown is, you know, the completely wrong ideas that Brown has about what's going through Jim's mind as they're talking, I thought was brilliant. I thought that was one of the best, but even though that whole part of the book, the whole part where they're explaining what happened to Jim, how Jim died, I found a little bit, it dragged a bit for me. But that one scene really picked up because it was obvious that Brown had ideas of his own, you know, his own self-importance. And that wasn't what Jim was thinking about at all. You know, Brown would say something and it would bring back what Jim had done. And Brown was completely unaware of what Jim had done.
Yeah.
So I thought that was fair. I thought that was really great writing.
I have a question, actually, which is, what is it people think about the structure of the book? About how Jim ends up going to, you know, this island and becoming a lord and everything that happened in the way. I mean, why do you think Conrad made the choice?
I think that it's interesting. I think that it just kind of goes to show, you know, Jim, whether you like him or not, Jim did have character. And that did come out no matter where he was. So you might think that you can slink off into the woods with your tail between your legs and never be heard of again, but you are going to rise to who you are. And that was him. You know, that was who he was. He went there and he wanted to, you know, lift these people up. He wanted to make things better. And, you know, he probably wanted to make things more British or whatever, you know, in some sense. But
why do you think Conrad did it this way? I mean, in terms of the Jim's evolving character and digging into Jim's character and what he had to struggle through, why is it that Conrad made this particular choice? I mean, aside from the fact that he, in and of himself, spent a long time in the Congo and stuff like that, and so he was, a lot of stuff probably was, you know, from his own experience, but I'm just wondering, I mean, because it seemed like such a stark difference. Why is it, let's say, he didn't make the choice for Jim to go on another ship and face the same sort of thing or face some kind of, you know, convolution of what happened. I mean, I'm just wondering why it was structured this way, because it threw me.
I think Jim needed a blank slate, right? He couldn't deal with the possibility that someone knew his past life, so he had to go to the secluded place where information didn't get in.
Yeah, no one spoke English, basically.
Yeah, and he wanted to, I mean, the event defined his entire life. It, you know, he was almost a slave to it in the sense that when he started over in this Patuzan place, he had to live the person he imagined himself to be. And I don't have any quotes, but I just remember, like, he was tired, you know. He was going place to place, solving arguments, you know, making ramparts. It was tiring.
And he was being pursued by the Patna affair everywhere he went. He couldn't get away from the person that he'd been every time he sort of got set up somewhere. And, you know, if it wasn't his inner sort of conscience haunting him, it was the rumors about the Patna affair, which Marlowe said never seemed to die. Someone, you know, it would reach the place where he'd been. And so he went to Patuzan to find the place, like you say, where he would be totally away.